I got into The Wire and I started watching it, and I was just like, wow. It was like watching a beautifully written novel. It was Shakespearean to a point, and I just was like, this is good. And then just knowing what we were about to do for season four, I was excited for just not myself as an actor, but the viewers to see that, like, they were going to take him into a completely different side of The Wire. And I didn't know if they were going to be ready for it, because I was nervous, man. After watching the first three seasons, I had fell in love with Idris and Avon and the Barksdales, and, you know, and I just was nervous, like, damn, we're going to be in a different world with these people, and I just hope they can accept it.
Hi, yeah, it's Dave here.
And I'm Kobe.
And this is The Wire Stripped. It's the podcast where we watched HBO's The Wire week in, week out.
And you don't just hear from us, with me, with a croaky voice. I apologize. You hear from the cast and the crew and some fans. That's you guys as well.
And if you want to chat to us, then do so at The Wire Stripped on Twitter, Instagram, all that stuff, at The Wire Stripped.
Yeah, today's episode is season 4, episode 3, Homerooms. Yeah, let's get into it.
Let's get down those homerooms.
When you walk through the garden, you gotta watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon. Walk the straight and narrow track. When you walk with Jesus, he's gonna save your soul. Just gotta keep the devil way down in the hole. He got the fire and the fury.
Okay, so we're on the railroads, we're on the train tracks. Nothing's happened here for a few years because
McNulty's on the straight and narrow.
He is. So
yeah.
No cops turn up and drink and
very
throw.
Quiet here. Yeah, we were looking around and there doesn't seem to be as many beer bottles and broken glass shards.
It's all cleaned up. It's a shame. Oh wait, what's that? There's two headlights in the distance there, Dave.
Oh, here they come.
I knew they couldn't. Yeah, I knew they could.
McNulty's back in action.
For a little taste.
Will we start there? Will we start with the Bug of McNulty? So you get a bit
Go on, let's go back to the old stuff.
So we get a bit of McNulty's new life here, don't we? So Bunk gets invited round for dinner, brings a nice red.
He feels very uncomfortable.
Yeah, he looks out of place, doesn't he?
In fact, they didn't even know. Did he want to put ice in the wine? I can't remember.
He wanted to put ice in that red wine.
In that red wine, yeah. So
which is not commonly done. But
no, I'm sure people do it, and I'm sure it's acceptable in circles. But generally, that's not what you do. And
no. But he also refused the ice. So McNulty said, "Do you want ice in it?" And he said, "Nah, man, that's a double digits wine," is what he said. So it's like he's cool in putting ice in a cheap wine.
That's probably the kind of thing I would have done as a student, to be fair. Just get the cheapest wine and to make it as palatable as possible, throw ice in there.
These guys are no good unless they're knocking back some beers or Glenfiddich and James. I think Glenfiddich is Bunk's...
Yeah,
drink, isn't
Jameson's
it? And
is.
Jameson is. Yeah.
Absolutely.
It is nice to see these two together again. Both,
it is, but always.
And it's interesting to watch them in these kind of, like, a bit of a different environment. Like, and they like, Bunk doesn't look comfortable. He doesn't look comfortable
not at all.
Looking at Jimmy in this environment.
He looks uncomfortable when he's not wearing a suit.
Yeah, right? He looks out of place. And I love the whole, there's a lot of comedy in here. And it's nice to see Beatty again, and it's nice that Bunk asks the kids, "You call him McNulty, not Jimmy, Uncle Jim?"
Yeah.
It's like,
McNulty.
McNulty, okay.
Fine.
It kind of checks out.
It is.
But we do ultimately get back to the railroad.
We do get back to the railroad, and Bunk is questioning McNulty's life. Saying, "Mate, you can't hide that from me," basically.
Bunk's a bad influence, right? It's like, leave Jimmy have his happy little life here.
He seems happy. He's doing well. He's a bit more chilled out. He's smiling. Let him smile.
He's happy. And, Bunk can't have it. He wants his mate back. He wants his drinking buddy back. But Bunk, there's a lovely bit of writing here. So, like, kudos to Richard Price, who wrote this episode. But the Bunk brings up this little nice little metaphor for Jimmy about this, and none of this means anything to me because I think we're just too far away here in old Blighty. But he's talking about corner shops that sell chicken and KFC and whatever, and they there's this, they advertise the fish as being lake trout, right? Even though we're nowhere near lakes, right? And he says it's marketing, but he says it's all dressed up like something it ain't.
Yeah.
And he kind of looks pointedly at Bunk, at Jimmy, basically like, this ain't you, Jimmy. You can dress up all you like as playing house, but you know, McNulty is McNulty.
I see you.
And I really like this line watching this episode, because that to me felt like it worked in a lot of these plots, you know, dressed up as something it ain't. You know, it also applied to Bunny, who we meet again in this episode, mm-hmm. Dressed up as this hotel security chief. Right? It's not quite right for him either. He's out of place. It applies to Michael on the corner, right? Michael like is good at it, but he's just doesn't seem out of it doesn't seem right, and like, he feels like he shouldn't be there.
Yep.
It applies to Prez, definitely. He's dressed up as something he isn't yet, or he will hopefully get better at. And we met the co-op again, and I feel like it could be applied to the co-op. They're dressed up as something they ain't. Like Stringer Bell was dressed up as something ain't, right? This criminal syndicate playing legitimate business and having meetings and minutes. And
you know, those little corner joints in the ghetto that sell subs and fried chicken, lake trout, like egg creams in New York.
No eggs, no cream.
Exactly. No lake, no trout.
Pogies. White fish. Trash fish.
Exactly. White trash fish. I mean, lake trout, that's all marketing. It's just all dressed up like something it ain't.
Oh, lake trout, the actual fish?
Boo hiss. This is Bubbles' tormentor, played brilliantly by the actor Armando Cadogan Jr.
Lake trout is a better version of catfish. Nice size, but still battered the same way, still cooked fried the same way. You know, but I just think it's a better version of a catfish. You know, some shit that we done made up, you know what I mean, that we eat and it's delicious, that we eat it with fries, or we put that mambo sauce, that hot sauce on it. You know, I don't eat the shit no more, because that, you know, that's some... when your body can afford to eat it at 14, 15 years old. But yeah, lake trout is a thing. That's a Baltimore classic. You know what I mean? That's a Baltimore classic. Lake trout with some wings, lake trout with a crab cake. Like, it's a classic. It's one of them things.
But what about in your notes, one? Sorry, we make notes, guys. Inside of baseball. You talked about Randy actually dressing up as something he ain't.
Yeah, he's literally putting on other kids' uniforms. He's literally dressing up as something. Yeah.
I love Randy. Yeah. This kind of wily coyote escapades. We'll get to Randy in a second. I think we talked about the introduction of, reintroduction, I should say, of Bunny. Should we go straight to him, or should we go?
Let's talk about Bunny. Oh, it's good to see him again. And we meet the Rev.
The Deacon.
What I like about the scene is that the Rev comes to Bunny's house, and he's we see that street, which is just littered with election signs.
Depressing. It's depressing amount.
He's so pissed off, and he says, "I take them in." They keep just bringing them out. And there's on the audio commentary on the Blu-rays, David Simon says that he asked the art department to ramp up the amount of election material that you see on the streets as the episodes go closer and closer to the election.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And then he asked them to ramp it down again. So it's like, that's how much thought was put into this. So
let's look after that, guys, in the next
closer
few episodes.
You get. Yeah. Yeah. And there's a brilliant scene. We'll get to Omar in a minute. But another great election moment was when Omar comes out of his house and tears down the...
It's Mayor Royce. Yeah,
Mayor
I noticed
Royce
that. Yeah.
Thing. I like that. But Bunny's back. The Rev's trying to get him to take a job down at the university, but he says, "Nah, I got this cushy hotel gig, man. Get a car and all."
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The take-home car. But it's not him. It's not him. He's dressed up as something he's not. And when we see that scene, he goes into the hotel room and is immediately on the side of the sex worker who's been abused against her John, who essentially gives the hotel lots of money, so they want to protect him. And that's what loses him his job there, because he's trying to do right, and the hotel like, well, we need his money because he brings conventions, which means a lot of money for us. Buddy just knows. I'm not sure if he's fired or he just leaves because he knows that's not for him.
Yeah, it's not quite clear, but either way, Bunny takes a stand.
Yeah.
To a point, like, he doesn't have the power or authority to arrest that guy,
yeah.
And he's reminded of that. But
you're not police.
He walks out of there.
That must have been absolutely gutting for him. You're not police anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. But I like this. This tells us that straight away, Bunny's the same Bunny.
Bunny's the same Bunny.
Right? He's a man of principles, and you just gotta love him.
But this leads us to. He goes back with his tail between his legs, but he speaks back to the deacon, and deacon introduces him to this project that the university are doing, where they're trying to kind of understand the youth on the street in Baltimore. Bunny says, and they want to speak to like 19 to 21 year olds, and Bunny's just laughing, going,
too old, man.
Too late. Too late.
Yeah.
I'll show you. And throws this wide eyed kid into holding cell. Carver's like, with Carver, and Carver says, you sure you don't want us to stay? But this kid absolutely tears into the university student stroke academic.
Yeah.
And
put that pen down. It's a scary kind of scene.
I was terrified. Yeah. I was terrified for myself, let alone for him in that room. And Bunny's just almost laughing, but also gets a chance to be his old Bunny, and you know, he wrestles him down onto the desk.
Yeah.
And that's where you see a bit of glint in, you know, you can see that kind of spark in his eye. Yeah. Back again,
and he's being useful, and this feels like such a good position for Bunny, isn't it? Because he's that he's an agent of change. He's someone who had a vision for a different kind of world,
yep.
And now he's teamed up with somebody who can actually maybe do that, can influence policy to a point where it might actually happen. And yep. I think these two feel like Parenti is the guy's name, Dr. David Parenti, strong name, David. Nice. He feels like
David Simon. Can't think of any other Davids around.
Wait a sec. He feels like these guys feels like a good pair, don't they?
Yeah.
Like they both totally. Have a common objective, but are from different worlds, and they kind of need each other. And I think this is an exciting kind of endeavor that, like, this is feels like a bit of season 3 energy, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally.
Like, can
totally.
They make a difference to these kids?
All I knew is that I was kind of broke without a job.
You are listening to the beating heart of The Wire. It's Robert Wisdom, Bunny Colvin.
And that I'd have to go back and you know, surrender my work and my services to security work, you know. I had no idea at the time of the schools and what was happening. I mean, I started doing some research when we kind of got a hint that because Ed Burns, that was also one of his provinces, is you know, as a teacher, so he's kind of getting schooled up on you know, issues of public schools and you know, in the hood and the politics of it and all that. But there was really all I knew is that, you know, I had a robe to put on in that first scene. That was, you know, where I meet Deacon on the porch. And then I later put on that blue blazer that the security guy wears. And, you know, none of them really fit, you know. It's just like, it was an odd feeling, but it was like, why am I, you know, it's like they didn't fit. And I think it was like a, you know, without lay too much on it, but it was like the body of Bunny was like, this isn't what you're gonna do, you know. So there was a little hunger that was with birth in those early moments, early episodes, but we had no idea where it was going, and I had no idea, hadn't met the kids yet, and they were amazing. Again, Alexa Fogle.
My reaction to that scene is, wow, can't we do both? Because I think Colvin's point is a really beautiful one. We have got to invest in kids as early as possible.
This is the voice of Kristen Henning. She's the director of the Georgetown Juvenile Justice Initiative, and she also wrote the book Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth.
And indeed, there's some research that shows that adolescents are most receptive to, most receptive and most resilient during those, you know, sort of middle to young to middle adolescent years. That said, there's also research showing that you can intervene even with the most violent offenders, right? Through community-based interventions, but you have to be tailored. There are some strategies called, you know, multi-systemic therapy, family functional therapy, adolescent, I think it's called regression therapy. There are ways in which we can engage that have been, you know, proven to work. But we've got to invest. We really, really have to invest in that to make those work.
Right. As you all know, we do have a Patreon page at patreon.com/thewirestripped. But we now have another way you can help us out, and the Ella Thompson Fund.
Yeah. So if you guys are listening on Apple Podcasts, you can subscribe to us to get a lot of the same benefits as a Patreon account. But it makes it easier if you want to help contribute to the lovely people at Ella Thompson Fund, who, just to remind you, I'm sure we've said a few times this episode already, but they help support underprivileged kids in Baltimore in the way that Cutty did in The Wire.
So you can get access to our episodes early. You can get access to our full interviews with the cast and crew, including our extended interview with David Simon.
No adverts on there as well. And also, Basking in the Glory, they help me out a lot of lovely people in Baltimore and the kids there. It's simple. If you're on Apple Podcasts, scroll up the feed now, and there's a button for you to click on, and it costs less than the price of a coffee every month to support lots of lovely people.
Yeah, Omar's back, guys. We always love it when Omar comes back, because he's fucking ace. I love the scene. He gets up, he doesn't have his Honey Nut Cheerios, and rightfully he's pissed off, and that sets him off in his silk pajamas.
Which he tries to holster the gun. Like this, oh my God, this scene's amazing. So many good little touches in it. He tries the back.
To holster basically a hand cannon to silk pajamas, which are designed to hold up nothing. And he's like, nah, that's okay, it's not going to work. And he just saunters open chested through the streets.
Yeah.
And everyone's running. Omar coming. At no point are they thinking Omar's coming, but also he's like naked.
It's so just the power of Omar.
Yeah, exactly.
He doesn't even need... He's not even concerned. He tries to... Kind of half-heartedly tries to hold his gun. He's like, whatever.
And later in this episode...
They all avoid him.
He's got his bulletproof vest on, but here, he's just bare-chested walking through the street because he's not on that mission today. He's on the mission to get Honey Nut Cheerios, and he can't get them.
But he's also so assured of his own power and authority.
Do you think...
Everyone just...
Do you think he's even thinking about it? Do you think... I'm not even sure he's thinking about that. I think he's just...
I just need to,
get some
cereal.
Yeah.
He does seem to just like walk through the world like a predator and everyone just steers clear.
Moves out of the way.
And you get that amazing comic moment where he stops for a cigarette and they just drop the package right next to him. Oh my God.
Absolutely brilliant. And then he picks up the package, goes back to Reynaldo, his partner, and it's like he's not even interested in that package. He needs a mission.
No.
Omar needs a mission.
Yeah. He said it's not interesting. The product, it's not about stealing the thing. It's about the thrill and the heist and the. And he says it later in the episode, and when they stick up that corner shop,
Old Face Andres.
It's about that. Yeah, that's him. It's about the look. He said that he gets the power. He gets the thrill from the power and the look of fear that he gets from that guy.
And Ronaldo here in that scene. This is what we see, which is. We get some proper good Omar. He's staking out the scene. He sees Kima.
But Kima doesn't see him.
Exactly.
Crucially.
Kima doesn't see him. He spots the re-up.
I love that. School doesn't start till tomorrow. Like, man, he's smart.
He's on it. He's on it right from the start. But when they do hold him up, Old Face Andre, he takes the re-up, pays for the cigarettes. Waits for his chains.
So good.
His boy Ronaldo's like, dude, what the fuck? Is Ronaldo new to him at this point? Is he still?
Yeah, feels like Ronaldo hasn't been on many jobs with Omar. This feels like Omar's vibe.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. But yeah, totally. Yes, this is great Omar through and through.
Oh, I loved it. I loved it.
Great reintroduction.
What a cold open. What a, you know, amazing scenes with Omar. So good to have him back.
They don't have the Honey Nut.
I don't even want this, Doc.
Why not?
It ain't what you're taking, it's who you're taking it from, you feel me? How you expect to run with the wolves come night when you spend all day sparring with the puppies?
Homerooms, because that was the first time we were in the school.
You're listening to Maestro Harrell, who played Randy Wagstaff.
That one, that was fire. And that was a lot of fun to shoot because it was just, you know, we finally, like, we in the school, so now we got all these other kids with us, and we're like, oh, it was. And then on top of that, come on, we're 14, 15, and 16, or 12, 13, 14, 15, or no, yeah, 12, 14, 15, 16. So at the end of the day, now we're also like, oh, we're in this whole classroom with what, girls? Oh, yeah. Like, you know what I mean? So that was even dope.
So we get, we'll start with Royce maybe. So Royce has assembled his league of
his brain
league
squad.
Of evil, his brain squad, yeah, and they absolutely get chewed out. And we see Royce is on the back foot now after the debate and mm-hmm. after the embarrassment with the state's witness, and he basically he's going dirty now, isn't
yeah.
he? So take down, clamp his vans outside his, put construction work outside his house, like he's just doing
take his signs
nasty thing. Take his signs, like you see why Royce got where he is, because he plays dirty and he plays to win.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting in this scene is that everyone kind of jumps when Royce snaps, including Burrell. You know, we'll bury this, whatever. But Odell Watkins doesn't seem impressed, does he?
Odell kind of just goes, dude, you had the money last year. You should have made good with it, and you didn't.
I brought this to you. You had the money. Pittance, quarter of a mil, man.
Mate, you should have used it then. And rightly, Royce is like, well, obviously, this is part of you saying playing his games. He knows how to play the game. If I use it now, then people are going to pull on that. I need to make sure I get re-elected and then pull out the
stage. Then do it. Yeah. He won't do it to give Carchetti the win, which tells you where his priorities
politicking,
are.
Politicking, yeah.
Right? He's more interested in his own re-election than
absolutely.
In doing the right thing.
And this
people
is
who were getting murdered.
Inherently the problem with politics. So we're solving politics right here in this podcast.
Yeah. It's obvious, guys.
if they're being voted in, they want to stay in.
And I remember the scene with Frankie Faison and Glenn Turman in the mayor's office. And I realized I am at a scene where you've got two black actors doing Shakespearean power moves around each other.
This is Ernest Dickerson, a director on The Wire.
You know, you got the mayor and the police commissioner, and they're making this deal, you know, in this wooden structure. You know, there was a situation where normally you wouldn't see black actors in that kind of a situation, and running those kind of, you know, power games around each other. But it was just fascinating. And you know, it was, you could tell that the actors were having themselves a great time. You know, it was great writing, there were great roles, and it was a whole lot of relish. I had known Frankie Faison for years. I first worked with him, I believe, in Do the Right Thing when I was cinematographer. And it was just good to, you know, work with him again and see him again and stuff. And Glenn Turman is black cinema history, you know. And it's always great to see him and work with him. And, you know, just to see those two guys in a room together and, you know, really going at each other was just a lot of fun. I did realize I was in a moment in history, too. They were playing the kind of scenes you don't normally see.
We have become extraordinarily good at politics, and by politics I mean the ruthless savaging of the opposition without any regard to the ideas undertaken.
This is, of course, the man himself, David Simon, the creator of The Wire.
Content doesn't matter. Maneuver matters. Power matters. What you actually do with that power, what you achieve with it, whether you leave your nation better or worse, is not the issue. The issue is maneuver and attack and dominate, and we're great at that now. We've got it down to a almost instantaneous news cycle of who's getting hurt, who's hurting them, how are they doing it, what can they use next. great at that. We may be the modern synthesis of media dishonesty and avarice. That's our political system. We are terrible. The worst we've ever been at governing ourselves.
So Calcatti's on the other side is feeling the pinch from Royce's attacks with the construction work on his campaign headquarters. But also at the same time, he's getting 30 grand super quickly. Everyone's donating to him now. And as D'Agostino says, he got to Royce and they're all smiling.
You really pissed him off.
Yeah.
Yeah, because laugh. This is a victory for them.
Yes.
This is a different Carcetti than we've seen in the previous two episodes.
Yeah,
like, he was done.
Yeah, he was
like,
ready to give up.
We didn't mention in the last episode, but like, he was just like, he would rather play Battleship with his daughter and play a game he could win.
I'd rather play Battleship with my kid than fucking be a mayor-elect or whatever.
Yeah, for sure. But that's where he was an episode ago, and now he's like, now he's back in action. The man's got fire. He's got the tables have turned. And we also get that scene later on at the funeral where we see a bit more of Carcetti being clever, right? Because he got an opportunity to play to the media. And, you know, as Norman describes it, Norman pushes him into the theater. You know, there's a good chance for theater here. But he says, well, who's the better audience here? Because he plays it cool in front of Odell and Daniels, Martha Daniels.
Yeah.
And he says, they're more valuable to see that I've got, you know, I'm in it for the right reasons.
Yeah.
And he's right, because Odell is clearly wobbling here about
supporting Royce. He's biding his time, biding his sides to, yeah.
It's smart. It tells us Carcetti knows what he's doing. He knows how to maneuver these waters.
Yeah. So Bodie's kind of by himself here. He hasn't got the power of the Bartsdale crew. He's doesn't want to side with Marlowe. It's kind of a strange predicament he's in. I don't know if not predicament is the right word, but he's kind of out by himself without protection. And for me, that's fucking scary.
And it is scary.
Yeah.
But he's done well in these three episodes. He's like turned it around. It's like things are getting busier. Like, because Bodie's good.
Mm-hmm.
And he's gotten the attention of Marlowe, hasn't he? So this is a crucial moment where Marlowe gives him the ultimatum. You either take my supply now or you get off this corner.
Yeah. That's a very aggressive buyout.
But he's got the muscle to back absolutely. It up, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's one of those things you kind of gutted. I was like, I built this up from scratch, man. But at the same time, Marlowe will come and kill you. And that's super dark. But
yeah. And he goes to Slim Charles for a bit of advice. And Slim Charles is coming from, you know, he's the Barksdale days. And
he hasn't got that power behind him either.
No, but Slim Charles knows when it's done. And
yeah.
I think he gives him the right advice. But Bodie doesn't take it. Bodie doesn't want to hear this. And because Bodie, as you said, doesn't want to give up what he's built.
Yeah.
So interesting times.
Man, when I came in, I didn't even know my character was going to be that significant of a part. And I think they kind of like fell in love with my voice and my stature and how I moved around with the rest of the cast.
You're listening to Anwan Glover, who played Slim Charles.
And they just started writing me in more. And the more and more I got wrote into the script, the bigger I got. And it was crazy because I was like, oh, I'm doing this week. Oh, so they building me. They building my character. So it was crazy just to have that script sent to me. And my lady printed out, my wife printed out online. And I'm like, okay, this description, and then I have to go secretly to pick up the script because you can't email the pieces. And I'm like, okay, this is secret, you can't. And then I'm like, okay, my character is really moving. I'm moving. So it was from Avon Boxdale to now I'm moving with the movers and the shakers with Prom Joe. And when I got with Prom Joe, that's when I just started growing even more. The old days. You know? And it was like JD's character was, he always was out there. He always was getting it. He never had a problem. But sometimes street people get caught up in, hey, it's the same way. But then you got these new casters coming in. It's a whole nother order. And I was just telling them, like, listen, now the old days are the old days, you know? So you gotta be careful.
I hated his character too at first. Jamie was my best man at my wedding. Because I worked with him on the TV series Bosch. And that's a whole other funny story. But yeah, he was best man at my wedding. But, you know, Marlo, he's not the kind of character that you admire. He's not the kind of character that you like. And actually, you know, when I first went back to the show in the third season and started seeing how Marlo was starting to eat into the Barksdale territory, you know, I was pissed off at this little guy. Who is this young motherfucker? Who do you think he is? You know? And then it got really serious in season four with the vacant and all the bodies turning up into vacant. You know, that was, oh my God, he's a monster. But he played it so beautifully. He just, you know, just straight ahead, you know, no emotion. There was no emotion to him at all. It was just pure calculation. He was almost like a black Vladimir Putin.
Dominic Tolan, Patreon member. The story of Randy Wagstaff is one of the most tragic stories witnessed in season 4 of The Wire. Arguably the brightest and one with most potential, his naivety and misplaced trust in authority figures serves only to see him be a victim of circumstance, ignorance and protocol. The contrast of the beaming confidence male of Randy, surrounded by friends in episode 1, to the frightened isolated figure in the final episode, demonstrates the detrimental effect of being caught up in the system.
Well, thanks so much for that burner message, and thanks for taking the time to leave a voice memo and sending it to our WhatsApp. If you guys listening want to do the same, you can do. Just leave a short 30-second voice memo to our WhatsApp at +44 7534 831 658. I don't know why I did that. But there's also a way which might be easier for them. Tell them, Dave.
Yeah, you could just send us an email. It's burner @thewirestrip.com. But goddammit! Use the phone. People don't pick up the phone enough these days, right? Send us a nice audio message, please, on the phone.
Yeah. And this week, we still want to know where season 4 ranks for you and why, of course. Let us know why.
And one more plug. We've got our Patreon, and it's very nice. And there's lots of amazing content on there. Great exclusive interviews with The Wire-related people. There's merch, apparently, which me and Kobe aren't allowed to have. You get priority burner access. You get to the front of the queue. Yes. And all of the money goes to a good cause, the Ella Thompson Fund in Baltimore.
Yeah, the Ella Thompson Fund is there. Think of what Cutty does for the kids after school and just gives the kids a place to hang out that's safe and clean and warm and fun, of course, after school. So the Ella Thompson Fund does that for those kids in Baltimore. And it's supported by David Simon and the whole of the team behind The Wire.
In the MCU, in the Major Crimes, there's a fallout of of Valchek snitching.
Yeah, they're all in panic mode, aren't they?
They're all in panic mode, and also Royce again probably pissed off with everything. They've changed out the sleepy lieutenant for Marimo.
Rawls and Burrell know how to gut this unit.
Yeah.
They know how to gut it good.
And they're putting Marimo, who's the editor of the Washington Post from House of Cards.
Yeah, yeah. Great actor.
And Lester Freeman refers to him as a virus. This is another person.
I love that.
We talked about Walker in the previous episode. This is another person who, on rewatch, I don't know why I put so much hate into Ziggy the first few times, but this guy, Marimo and Walker, yeah, they're fucking knobheads.
He's hateable.
Yeah.
As soon as, what's his word? It's like, I'm all about supervision, right? That's what he wants. It's just like,
I want to know every step of the way.
And you know he's just this stooge, this career guy. Yeah. When you see him with Rawls and he's like, right, what about the subpoenas? What do you want me to do? It's just like, ugh.
And Asher, is it Asher? Hopefully he gets kicked off. Hopefully gets his boat. I want to see his boathouse.
He gets kicked down to what, phone... phone division,
watching phones,
phone scams. <is that? laughs> He's heading up the phone scam department or something. We get a lot of Rawls in this episode, though.
We do, yeah.
You see, you're reminded of Rawls's cunning.
Yeah.
And his, like, he wins. He basically beats Freeman, yeah. Right? Or Freeman knew he couldn't win this game anyway. But what I like is that Rawls, unlike, you know, previous, you know, Rawls doesn't do what he did to McNulty. He doesn't send him to the boats. He doesn't send, like...
That's true.
He respects Freeman, and he says, you know, this is, you're a fine damn police. So Rawls, and we see this occasionally with Rawls. Rawls is a dick, and he's up Burrell's and Royce's ass, and he's playing the game with everyone else. Mm-hmm. But he knows good police people, and he's a good person when he needs to be. We saw it when Kima got shot,
yeah,
in season one, and that amazing scene where he tells McNulty it's not his fault.
Yeah.
And we see it here again when he does right by Freeman, even though he just knows he can't back Freeman's move with the subpoenas, but he gives him a nice spot in Homicide,
yeah,
where his talents can be used.
Yeah, this is completely right. You know, we said back in season one, this is why Rawls is where he is, because he's a good police officer, and he's a dick for many different reasons, but ground one is he's a good police officer.
Yeah.
And we saw, you know, and that's part of why there's fear when it goes to Comstock, because he's seeking out these poor police officers who've kind of made it up the ranks somehow. He loves Freeman. He knows that team is talented. He's just like, guys, you've really backed me into a corner here. So yeah.
Rawls is just playing the game.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
Freeman is less self-destructive than McNulty, so he has a limit. And in fact, we see it.
This is Eric Deggans. He's the TV critic at NPR.
I mean, the reason that he winds up back in Homicide is because he just decides, okay, you know, it doesn't make any sense for me to keep, you know, pushing this boulder up this hill. He will stop before. And you know, he experienced that. You know, when we meet him, he's someone who kind of got crushed by the system. And he learned from it. So he's not willing to push it to the point of self-destruction the way McNulty is. McNulty will push it and push it and push it, and he won't care who it hurts, even if it hurts him, even if it hurts people around him. He doesn't care. He'll keep pushing it. And Freeman's not like that.
Well, you know, Freeman was always an interesting character from the first season when he was taking those little houses and everything. I've been a fan of Clark's for years. I think I first saw Clark, you know, because Clark came out of, well, he was originally in America, but, you know, he started a large part of his career in England. First time I saw him was in the movie Outland, Sean Connery, where, you know, he tries to assassinate Connery at the end. And then I'd seen him in some other stuff. I think he was also in Mona Lisa, I believe. But you know, it's just, you know, black actors who impress you, and you're always happy to see them pop up and other stuff. And you know, and then I get a chance to work with him. You know, the name was really cool. So it was great to see that character. You know, but he was always more the intellectual of the bunch, the mastermind who's able to, like, figure stuff out.
But he does write by Kima as well.
Yeah.
And not only that, he's going to kick someone off Homicide so he can get her in.
I love how Kima went to...
Who do I not like right now?
I love how Kima went to Daniels on that, and Daniels went up to Rawls. It kind of shows the ways through to...
Well, it is all like, it's like anything in life, it's who you know, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So in the previous episodes, we've been separating the school from the boys, but this is where they perhaps come together in their storylines.
Yeah, school's in.
Yeah.
For summer. School's
in. It doesn't work.
Summer's over. School's in for autumn.
School's
or fall.
For fall, yeah.
Fall, as you all say over there.
You Americans.
Yeah.
You guys on the other side of the pond. I apologize.
So we just lost all our American listeners. They're out. They're gone. That's half our base, man. Yeah. So I like that we see school is like a real leveler, isn't it? It's a level playing ground. It's neutral ground for everybody, no matter where you're coming from. And we see all the boys coming together from their different backgrounds, but they're all wearing the same uniforms.
Yeah.
But yet you can't, your home life kind of still follows you in there a little bit. And you get that with Dookie, There's a lovely little moment where Randy just subtly hands him his lunch. Did you
Brilliant.
Notice
lovely,
that?
Yeah, I saw that.
It's beautiful.
And this is part where we're in episode one, these guys take care of each other. They can rip into each other, but no one else can do so. And they're tight within each other. Apart from, and again, Hissable character, but also played amazingly when they go to Naaman's house. And Naaman's mum doesn't let Dookie go into the house.
That is, I fucking stood up from the chair. How dare you not let Dookie into that house?
I can completely see why.
I know. It's like this one. It's one thing kids teasing kids, and that kind of isn't, you know, it's unfortunate, but it's going to happen. But she's a fucking grown ass woman.
And that's, and
it's despicable.
It's tight. It's not tight. It's terrible. And but the way that Dookie just kind of was like, oh, okay, this is, he's just resigned to that kind
oh,
of.
Oh, sad. Yeah, that's yeah. just his life. He's used to being a pariah.
Yeah.
I think that the episode with Dookie, which I'm, a little tear came up in my eye. Jermaine Crawford, Jermaine played it excellent. His mother and I went to junior high school in D.C.
This is actor Sandy McCree, who played the absolutely hissable Delonda Bryce.
And the tear comes up in my eye because that scene was like, and it was like, it was like one of my short days. It was slamming the door in his face. So I'm like, okay, whatever. When he comes up, all the boys coming in. I'm all excited, you know, little play dates for Naaman. You know, they're doing their little thing. Coming home, you know, to my house. I love when kids hang out. And then Dookie brings his dirty butt up in there. I think it wasn't her feeling superior. I think it was her not wanting to go back to that. I think that's what she, it's a reminder. It's a reminder of a life that she wants no part of ever again. So that's when she's looking and she slams that door. That's what it is. She slammed that door on her past life. That's all my backstory.
Oh, man, Sandy. Sandy, it's interesting the character she plays because she just happens to be one of the sweetest women on the planet.
This is, of course, the one and only Naaman, played brilliantly by Julito McCullum.
Yo, even when I moved to LA in 2018 for a bit, and she took care of me like I was her son. That's just who she is. She's just a sweet, kind lady. And just an amazing actress. And we had that mother and a son relationship on set, and it worked out perfectly for the characters. And their relationship, man, you know what it is? That Delonda Bryce was, she lived in scarcity, man. It was all about scarcity for them. She didn't want to be what she saw outside of her house, outside of her apartment. She wanted her son to have a different life. And all she knew was the drug world. And all she knew was, I have this kid who's from this Barksdale organization. And that's the only hope we have is this drug world. And we have to use this drug world as much as we can. And she had to do what she had to do, man. And of course, was it right or wrong? I think it's kind of hard to tell, but she only knew one thing. And I think that's the issue in those communities, man, is those folks have no other options. It's what they feel, right? They have no other options, so they have to be what they have to do. And she was, you know, probably from a broken home herself and didn't have much and knew what it was to suffer, and she didn't want that for her son. So she pushed him into a world that she may not have. It may not have been the right decision, but it was, in her head, her only decision.
Let's talk about Dookie for a minute, because we get... He doesn't say much. You don't get much from Dookie, but like what his thread through this whole episode is just literally finds a broken air conditioner, and throughout the course of the episode, you see him tinkering away until he fixes it at the end. And this is day one, man. It's like the potential in Dookie as the intelligence and the creativity. It's just so tragic to see it be crushed like that.
Smushed to bits.
I initially auditioned for Michael.
You're listening to Dookie himself, played by actor Jermaine Crawford.
A few times, like three times, and then they threw me Donut, and then they were like, no, like, for the screen test, when it was me, David, Nina, rest in peace, Robert Chu, sorry, rest in peace, Robert Chu, I went and did the Dookie screen test, and that was an experience also. That was an experience, because when I auditioned, I was still a little timid. I mean, this is like bigger than anything I've ever done. And I did what I thought was a good audition. And I remember him saying, like, cut, give me a second. Let me go outside and talk to him. So he pulled me to the side and he was like, look, boy, this role is yours. Like, give it to us. Let it go. Lose yourself in this room. This is yours if you want it. And yeah, I took those words and I went back in and smashed it. Kind of unfortunately at the time where I was in my life, I was just really in a space where I could easily identify with Dookie, you know, just kind of still figuring it out, feeling a little ostracized a little bit, sometimes like the oddball. And I think especially like Nina Noble and David Simon, they know, they smell blood in the water. So I think I truly identify with that character.
Then you have like the Dookie, who's literally like, oh, like if you had anyone who gave a shit about you, like you had intelligence.
You're listening to Maestro Harrell, who played Randy Wagstaff.
You know what I mean? There's a ton of, there's a lot of people who I know or I've just seen and they don't get a chance to reach their full potential just due to, you know, society, life, whatever. But man, like when you see people who are really actually gifted, but there's no outlet, it just shows you that it just shows you, you know, things aren't fair, you know, things aren't fair, not everybody gets a crack at opportunities that they should, because you know, at the end of the day, it all comes down from, you know, where you're from, who you know, what's your certain, because at the end of the day, it's like, man, just even if a Dookie had a, even if he had somebody who cared as much, how Naaman's mom cared about him being awesome. If he had somebody who gave a half a shit, you know what I mean? That's what I'm saying. Just clean clothes and be like, hey, you know, we got these food stamps. Just go to school. We'll figure it out.
As an aside to the four boys in the school, we see Przybylowski taking his first classes and being way out of his depth.
So out of his depth. I had the sweats watching Prez in this classroom, right? Because it's one of my worst fears. It's a job I could never do. Being a teacher. Like I have some serious. All right, I have some fears in my life. Like I fear like things I can imagine myself that would be the worst nightmare for me. One is like a lot of people like being in prison. I think I wouldn't survive a day.
No, yeah, sure.
But also a close second is being a teacher in a classroom. How do people do it? My God.
They'd eat me alive. Not all heroes wear capes.
They really are superheroes.
Although he starts off the wrong footing with one of the lamest jokes I've ever seen.
So good. So awkward. This is Curb Your Enthusiasm level cringe.
Just wants to get your head and bury it under the sand and then dig yourself to the center of the earth because it was that bad, a joke.
You just forever reminder for everyone, he does the old, my name is Mr. Przybylowski, but you can call me Mr. Przybylowski.
Good morning. I'm your homeroom teacher, obviously. My name is Mr. Przybylowski, but you can call me Mr. Przybylowski.
And you just know he'd been practicing that in the mirror, right?
Okay, let's find out who you are.
This is...
He woke up thinking...
I got it.
Yeah. That's going to kill.
Win him over quick. Bit of humor. Man, he's doomed. It's like, and nobody in any new job wants to have to be rescued by somebody else over and over again. You know, that teacher keeps having to come in.
We need to learn the name of that teacher because she is fucking brilliant.
And she's a badass.
She commands respect just with her voice. But also, cutting straight to the end of this episode, and this is why I linked it with the Dookie bit, because he fixes the fan at this point. A sideline, a B-plot in this episode is two female students who are at odds with each other, and it comes to a boiling point where one is kind of getting attacked. She pulls out a standing knife or a box cutter and slashes this other girl's face. Fucking brutal scene.
Yeah, really brutal. It's the last scene of the episode.
It leaves us on such a sour note. But this other teacher, she comes in and she sorts it out straight away. She pulls the fight apart.
That tells you that it's not her first time,
it's
right?
It's not her first time.
That tells you how common this can be.
Yeah.
And Prez, and by stark contrast, Prez is completely ineffective.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
He's a bystander.
He might as well be another pupil there.
Yeah.
It's a horrible way to end the episode. A horrible thing to happen.
Yeah.
But we're okay. Randy Naaman and Michael.
Well, we see a lot of Randy's entrepreneurial spirit here, don't we? Again,
hijinks, yeah.
Like, oh my god, how he's a bit like Lester Freeman unleashing his master plan, right? So he spots the opportunity. Firstly, he knows how to play Prez
straight away.
Does the handshake, nice to meet you. Knows it's all smiles.
Oh, beautiful.
Can I have a hall pass, sir? Takes a whole bunch.
Beautiful.
He's got his Prison Break. He's got his like. Slips out when there's the fight with the girls.
It was just waiting for a time. It could have been Prez sneezing, but
yeah.
Conveniently it was something that was like, okay, this is actually a big ruckus.
I can get out of it.
Yeah.
It's seamless.
Yeah,
it's like
beautiful.
The execution of Randy's master plan is just flawless. He's got down at the locker, gets the clothes on, and he's selling Twizzlers down in the down in the canteen to different grades.
On. Yeah.
Oh my god. It's awesome.
I love Randy in this.
We speak of potential. Like, all the boys have so much potential, don't they?
Yeah.
Except Naaman.
And that's the source of the heartbreak. Because if they had nothing going for them, then...
Yeah, then you'd be like, well, you got nothing going for you.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
But each of them got potential in different ways. As we talked about the archetypes in the first episode. But the potential hasn't been realised yet for... I guess Michael and Naaman yet, but with Dookie and Randy, we can see it. Like we can see the seeds that's coming through.
It.
Yeah,
I feel like that they were all kids though. Like we weren't on like no, not another teen movie site where the high school kids were like 20 in their 20s. Like no, they were all young thespians.
This is the voice of Nathan Corbett, who played Donut.
They were all young actors, you know, and so And that was one of the good things about the city, right? And that's one of the good things about that season, which made it so authentic, was that they really pulled from these different places. And also, Mr. Robert Chu, who played Prop Joe, he ran a thespian club around here called Arena Players, which still goes on. And I think it's one of the oldest black theaters in America, one of them. And he was our acting coach. Like as the kids and stuff, he was our acting coach on set. And so the kids that he would work with at the at the Arena Players, they would like some of them would audition for the show and some of them would have roles, right? So some of the kids that were in the that were in those school scenes, like actually Rashad Orange, he played Bubbles. He played Bubbles Man, and Sherrod Orange and his sister Rakaya, they both I think were in Arena Players under Mr. Chu as well, you know. And so that's one of the things that made it so authentic, was they really pulled kid actors from the area, right? And really gave these kids a chance and put these kids on a major, major platform. Well, I'm saying these kids like I'm not one of them. And put us all on a major platform. And that's what, like I said, what made the show so authentic.
Of now in Florida, they have a way of creating schools that you apply to that you can get into through a lottery where... they require the parents to come to PTA meetings and they have dress code and all this kind of stuff. And if you don't do it, you get kicked out. And so it's a way of sort of self-selecting and elevating kids who have motivated parents out of the general schools, which are still much better than the ones that we're seeing in The Wire. I mean, they're much better. But you know, it's odd to see public school systems struggle to educate average children. You know, there really should be a way to give average kids the best educational experience possible. And in too many communities, we've seen the school systems kind of give up on the average kids and just try to figure out how to harvest the kids who are the smartest and the ones who are going to go on to college and the ones who are talented.
either athletically or intellectually. And then, you know, the rest of the kids are just kind of left to fend for themselves, which is not great. So The Wire, you know, is telling that story in sharp relief in the fourth season. But some of those scenes are hard for me to watch.
That was it. That's Pat Moran, man. She made sure she placed real kids in that school. Some were actors, of course, but the majority were just kids, man. And it really was ran like a real school. So imagine you trying to have hundreds of kids pay attention to. And so it felt like school, man. It felt like my neighborhood. It felt like when I was in middle school. And there's a weight that that carries, right? That you're trying. Like, yeah, we are actors on this show, but this is their real life, and we have to do it justice, because if we don't, we're there to tell the story for those who can't speak, right? And I felt an immense sense of gratitude that wasn't my life anymore, but also it was humbling. It was a humbling experience. And those kids were the best, man. I had so much fun, especially, you know, when my character got to be in like a more intimate space with them. Those kids are amazing, man. Some of them still reach out to me to this day, which is beautiful.
I think it's fair to finish on just the last two boys of summer. It's been a quiet episode for these guys, but we see Michael with Bug.
Oh yeah, we meet his little brother, but oh my god, he's the cutest little kid. And oh my god, Michael, this isn't what makes you love Michael even more, doesn't it? Because he's just this perfect older brother.
Protective old, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Doing his shoelaces, adorable. Making sure he's at school, at the school gates. Where's Michael? Oh, he's making sure he gets to school on time.
Oh, god. As a father of two boys, you're just like, if my boys could be anything like Michael and Bug, besides all the drug dealing and all the murder that surrounds them, I'd be very happy.
And then the other piece to finish on, I guess, is Naaman walking into school with
his brand new clothes.
With his brand new clothes.
His mom got him.
Yeah. And the bling. And I mean, my school wore, I had school uniform in my school. And if I turned up
me too.
Without school uniform, it would be very apparent, and they would say, "Why aren't you wearing school uniform? Take it off. Take off that shit. Put your school uniform back on."
Exactly what happened.
Yeah. Within seconds. And he looks, oh man.
But like, he kind of knew it was going to happen. I like that.
He's just fronting, isn't he?
That's what I like about Naaman. And like, he's quite a dick and very kind of brash and egotistical. But I like that he's like, he's got confidence and he knows that he's going to have to take it off. He doesn't even get 10 steps in the door.
No.
But he does it anyway. And it's kind of him expressing himself in a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I quite like as well.
Yeah, he had those kids at school who was, you know, they had the big earrings, or they put, you know, boys weren't allowed to wear ear piercings, but they did, but they put a plaster over it.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. You're like,
why
come
bother?
On.
But I do love his confidence.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
And I love, he's kind of the Joker in the classroom as well. Like, every classroom's got one.
Absolutely.
Like the Andre thing with Prez and the Andre from the West Side.
Yeah, yeah.
Traveling 80 miles per hour from West Baltimore.
Oh, Prez.
Yeah.
I was just, again, back to Prez and that lesson. I was just like, oh, Prez.
I like that he switched it up by the end of the day. He's like, right, the train's not going to work. We'll do a rocket ship. They can't stick Andre from into a rocket ship. Who do you think solved, you know, Prez finds this bit of paper at the end. Someone has perfectly solved his math.
I initially thought Dookie, but at the same time, I don't know if it was.
Yeah, I don't know, because it didn't seem like Dookie was sitting towards the back.
Yeah, exactly. It's just by...
I guess it doesn't matter who it was, just as long as
someone did it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's for a lot of teachers, I know that, you know, that one kid is paying attention, that one kid is doing it, even if they're in a sea of knobhead kids. That's the gratification you get.
Yeah, that must be what keeps you going. Because you're right, that final scene with Prez kind of sums up what I imagine being a teacher is like. Because it's like mostly very disheartening.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he starts with turning the desks over and, oh god, the chew's got to scrape all that chewing gum off again.
Yeah.
Then he finds this thing and is like, oh my god, I reached somebody. And then he picks up a paper and says, fuck you, Prez, or something. Fuck Prez, bro. Fuck Prezbo on the desk. So it's just like, yeah. So it's kind of like shit sandwich, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, poor Prez.
a shit sandwich, but it's two pieces of shit with a nice thing in the middle. The bread's so, in the middle.
Ham.
The shit is the bread.
Yeah.
But it's got like ham and cheese in the middle.
So you're saying double the shit.
So it's double the shit, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that was a pretty clean metaphor.
And that's it for episode 3. A huge thank you to the amazing people that we got to speak to this season and this episode.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always astonished at the people who send us an email back and say, yes, I will do it. So thank you so much. And it takes a lot of time to transcribe and write these interviews down so it's in a cohesive form. And we use Sonics, transcribing software to do that for us. And if you want to get a little something off Sonics and you want to help with transcription, go to sonics.ai/invite/stripped and you get a little discount courtesy of us.
And you might have seen our amazing artwork for this season, the illustration of the Four Boys of Summer. That was done by the brilliant Michael Balestrieri, and you can look at all his work at Black Snow Comics on Instagram. And of course, thank you to Izzy Lawrence, who produced our lovely logo.
Yeah. Cheers, as always, to Sam and Martin from the Song by Song podcast for making the tune, the version of Way Down in the Hole that you guys can listen to now.
And thank you to the one, the only legend, producer Opie.
Yeah. And of course, our lead producer and sometimes fact checker and editor. Yeah, well, always our editor, Tom T-Bone Wally.
Sometimes editor. Sometimes he's editing this show. And then you can also chat to us at all the socials at The Wire Stripped.
And if you want to leave us any messages, we always love to hear from you guys. So send us an email to burner@thewirestripped.com.
As mentioned, we've got a Patreon, patreon.com/thewirestripped. Head over there for loads of good stuff, and all of your money goes to the Ella Thompson Fund.
Yeah. Final plug, do leave us a little review on your favorite podcast, the same app that you're using to listen to this right now. Just give a little tap, the 5-star tap. It's much appreciated and helps other people to find the show.
And we'll be back in a week to watch more of The Wire. The next one is called Refugees, episode 4. See you there.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.